We'll call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. And quorum is present. Members, we have two sets of minutes to approve. Those from the Monday meeting and also from the joint meeting that we had with Chairman Eakin's committee yesterday afternoon. Representative Reiner, would you care to move the minutes for the Monday, February 12th meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Reiner. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The minutes are approved. Representative, who was there? Representative Reiner, I think it falls to you again to move approval of the minutes for the February 13th meeting.
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The February 13th minutes are approved. And first on our agenda today, we have Representative Kahn, House File 446. Representative Kahn, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. House File 446 is the bill that I've been introducing for about 8 years or so. And it does not break new ground, although it might be break some new ground in Minnesota. But what it is recognizing that one of the forms of pollution that we need to deal with in the world is the issue of light pollution.
Representative Kahn, could you pull the mic a little closer, please? Okay.
It is the issue of light pollution. Now, this is a bill that sets up some standards for the control of light pollution, which it turns out is also an energy conserving issue. I mean, I once flew in over the city of Minneapolis with someone sitting in the seat next to me, and as you looked at over the metropolitan area, and as you looked down, he pointed out that every light that you could see was totally wasted light. In terms of the only people who were benefiting from looking at that light were those of us in the airplane. Anyway, I do have someone who has worked on this probably even longer than me, who I'd like to introduce to go over the basic philosophy of that issue, and that's Tina Thevenin, who lives in Lake City. So.
I'll give a very brief background as to who I am. I'm a member of the International Dark Sky Association and the contact person for Minnesota. About 8-9 years ago, I received about $11,000 grant from the University of Minnesota to study what was known about outdoor lighting and pollution and to put together a presentation. I then, for about 3 years, between the year 2000 and 2003, went around the state to give, I gave about 75-85 presentations to raise the level of awareness of what is happening with our outdoor lighting. What I will do today is to give you about a 7-minute presentation on that, to give you a greater understanding of the problems with uncontrolled outdoor lighting. And as we can see from
Ms. Thevenin, before you continue, could you please identify yourself for the record?
Tina Thevenin from Lake City, Minnesota.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The purpose of outdoor lighting is security and visibility. Makes a lot of sense. The problem that we're facing today is that we're losing, that we're using quite old technology, and we have not really studied what we're doing with uncontrolled outdoor lighting. And that is what I would like to address. The problems with outdoor lighting are significant. One of them is the sky glow, and you will know that if you go out to northern Minnesota and you come driving back about 100 miles out, you will already begin to see the sky glow above the Twin Cities. That means that when you're in the cities and you look up, you don't really see the stars. And what we're doing is we're ruining for future generations something that's very precious and beautiful. It's like cutting down a forest or filling in wetlands. We are polluting the night sky. There is also a 30-40% waste of energy in the way that we are using the outdoor lighting today. There is excessive lighting, and there is also wasted money because of the excessive lighting and the wasted energy. There is also a tremendous problem with glare. Glare is, and I hope that all of you from now on at night when you're driving or when you're walking, you'll become very familiar and appreciate what it means to have a glaring light in your eyes, and we'll go into that a little bit more. But this is the energy use and the glare, which cuts down on the safety, are the two issues why so many states are looking at laws. Then there is the light trespass issue, because you see the light here shines all over the place. The light trespass is where light shines into people's homes where they don't want it. And then there is the issue of darkness. When you have a glaring light shining in your eyes, you can actually see less in dark areas, which it increases the hazards of being able to see whether it's actually secure to go somewhere. This is a very, very revealing chart. This was taken in 1908. As population grows, so does night light. This is Los Angeles in 1908 and Los Angeles in year 1988. You can see the tremendous difference because of population increase. Wherever people live in the world, there is outdoor lighting. Look at all this lighting. It is energy waste. It is increased air pollution, greenhouse gases, light trespass, that much more problems with glaring lights. This is a very telling picture of what is happening. As a matter of fact, I can show you a picture that is even more telling, and that's this one, the United States at night. Here is Minneapolis. This, it says here that $2 billion per year is wasted on energy lighting up in the sky. We don't need it in the sky. We need it on the ground. And this this $2 billion was about, it's a figure of about 8-9 years ago. So we don't know what it is today, but it certainly hasn't increased. It's absolutely wasted energy, that much more pollution. So it makes sense to start saying, why are we using old technology? Is there something better to use? Well, yes. It's called full cutoff light fixtures. It's very basic. This is called a shoebox fixture. The light bulb is inside this fixture. Guess what? It shines the light down where it is needed. We need it on the ground. We don't need it on the side of buildings. We don't need it up to shine up to the light, the belly of airplanes or the birds that fly over. We need it to shine down. And this is, now that you are aware of this, you start looking around at parking lots, newer parking lots. You start looking at the newer highway sections with the lighting. You'll begin to see this type of lighting where the light bulb is inside the path, not in the drop lens where it shines out and over. And there are also good and bad with the decorative lights where the light bulb is inside. Now the question is, why should this start saving money? Well, it's kind of like a flashlight. You all know the little flashlight. The light bulb itself is a little itty-bitty tiny light bulb. It doesn't really give that much light. But why is it effective? Because it has a shiny surface behind it. Now when they have this, it is not just a piece of tin foil that they put behind it. There's an incredible amount of research that goes into with fish scales and what do you do behind the light so it doesn't cause more light here than over there. There's continual research. but it is getting finer and finer and finer. What they're finding out is that they can really cut down on the amount of energy, the amount of wattage that goes into this light in order to get the same amount of light on the ground. But guess what? Because it is not glaring in your eyes, you can actually see better. And the next time that you're walking around, or you're driving around, and you see a glaring light, do something. Put your hand between the light and yourself, and then look. And you will find out that you can see much better without that glare than when you take your hand away. All of a sudden, it's not that clear. And that's what's happening with the lights. When they shine down, they can use less light, less pollution, less cost to energy, and you can see better. That is one of the, you would call it a no-brainer. And it's catching on more and more. One question, do lights result in greater security? Well, in 1977 and 1997, the Law Enforcement Assistant Administration Department of Justice did a thorough research, and they found out that there is no statistically significant evidence that street lighting impacts the level of crime. Everybody thinks that if we have bright lights, glaring lights, it will reduce the level of crime. But it doesn't. In fact, it may even increase it. Vandalism is the same thing. Vandalism with all these lights, it's kind of saying to the vandals, hey, we've lit up the whole place for you. So, the question is Minnesota going to be the only one, or the first one, to do something about this? Well, no, it isn't. This map, again, is about 8 years ago. But the states that have adopted some type of law are Arkansas, Arizona, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Georgia, Maine, New Jersey, New Mexico, Texas, Rhode Island, and Wyoming. So Minnesota is not going to be a daring state. It's going to be following what other states have already done. And there are proposed or introduced laws. In Connecticut, that is a little bit different law. Iowa, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Hampshire, New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Wyoming. So I would say it's about time that Minnesota, which has always been known as such a progressive state, that we start looking at saving energy, saving the night sky, making it safer for people to drive and to walk, safer neighborhoods by using up-to-date technology and get rid of the old technology. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Are there questions for this witness? Representative Kahn, how do you want to proceed?
Mr. Chairman, I have two more people to say, to speak briefly on this. One, Mr. Botsik. Is he here? No. Okay.
He was blinded by the glare on the way in.
Okay. He has a statement from the Audubon Society in support of this bill in terms of its effect on wildlife. And the other, and I would also like to point out today that there was the lead article in the Sparrow Tribune today was on a proposal that's been done very widely throughout the Mississippi Flyway to turn off the lights, these are even internal lights, on skyscrapers and buildings in the city during the migration system, which is again showing the many ways this affects. The next person I'd actually like to bring up is Sean Finwall, who's a city planner from Maplewood, and Maplewood has an ordinance that has had an ordinance for several years dealing with this. So she'd like to say something about the word. And you have that in your packet of materials. You have the Maplewood ordinance.
Well, we'll finish with the testimony and then take questions, Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Representative Kahn and members of the committee. Representative Kahn requested that I come here tonight and just give you a brief outline of the City of Maplewood's ordinance. We enacted an ordinance in 2001.
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, absolutely.
Please.
My name is Sean Finwall, and I'm one of the city planners with the City of Maplewood. So the City of Maplewood enacted an ordinance in 2001, and this was based on concern by our Community Design Review Board. It's a board of five members who are appointed by our council. These members look at architectural, lighting, design standards within the city, and they noticed a strong trend by many of these retailers, mainly big box retailers, installing bright lights, which took away much of the stars from the sky at night, also caused several nuisances. So they brought in some speakers to the board meetings and eventually enacted this ordinance, which requires that all new commercial and multifamily developers submit a photometrics plan whenever they're proposing a new development. And this photometrics plan has to indicate the amount of light illumination up to the property line. We require that it be restricted to 0.4 foot candles, and a foot candle is basically how far you can see a candle by 1 foot. So 0.4 is pretty dark at the property line. We also require that the lights have this strict light cutoff, as Representative Kahn and the previous speaker were referring to. And we found that this ordinance has been has assisted us in reducing nuisances and reducing night glare from our city. I do know of seven other Twin City communities that have these ordinances. Some of those are Bloomington, Plymouth, Blaine, St. Paul, White Bear Lake, Woodbury, and Burnsville. And all of them are enacted or put in place to help reduce light pollution. And, of course, a fallback of that is the energy savings. I'm not an expert in the lighting field, so I did contact a person that I work with quite frequently on developments. He submits the photometrics plans. He works for Weber Electric, which is a local electrical company here in the Twin Cities. And he had indicated that the best way to control glare is to have at least a 90% cutoff on these lights. Also, I asked, do you feel that an ordinance such as the City of Maplewood's or such as the bill that's being proposed here would help save energy? And he indicated that, well, it's clear that when you're not lighting areas that don't need to be lit, there's certainly an energy savings there. And we feel that our ordinance meets the sustainable building design standards, which are becoming quite common throughout the country. These are standards based on the design of buildings and developments to reduce energy use and also create sustainability. And the state of Minnesota does have a sustainable building standard requirement currently with all state-funded buildings. And just a personal note, I live in the city of Afton, and I am near the Afton Alps. And they have the brightest lights all winter long, and every winter my stars are taken away, and I get so frustrated with that type of situation. And I asked the gentleman at Weber Electric, would it help a situation like Afton Alps, which is a ski hill, you know, to install these clear cutoffs? And he said, yes, that certainly would assist in saving on that night glare, but, you know, with the snow, you're going to have that glare from that snow situation. And then another point of interest is these new billboards that you've seen installed throughout the Twin City area. And the city of Maplewood fell prey to one of those billboards. We're dealing with Clear Channel now on that issue. But this billboard is about 100 feet from a residential property, and you drive by that billboard at night and it lights up their entire backyard. So that's one issue we'll be dealing with Clear Channel on, ensuring that our ordinance is enforced in that regard. So I guess that's all I have to say about our ordinance. We do feel it's a good ordinance. It's quite similar to the other ordinances I had referred to throughout the Twin City area, and I would be very supportive of a statewide ordinance ensuring that any publicly funded lights met this cutoff requirement. It just seems really like a good idea and a way to reduce pollution, and I think that night glare is a form of pollution. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fenwell. Representative Kahn, we don't actually have your bill before us at this point. The chair will move that House File 446 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Local Government. So we do have your bill before us, and I understand you have some author's amendments. Would you like to deal with those
at this time? Let me point out, Mr. Chairman, let me point out in the packet of materials we gave you, which included the Maplewood ordinance, there are three pieces. I'm certainly not going to read them to you now. This one called Lights Out Twin Cities is the one that Mr. Botsek brought us from the Audubon Society. This one called, this is a one from darksky.org, which talks about the issue of responsible outdoor lighting. And then this is a specific example of the energy saving that was shown by the City of Calgary. This is a piece too. So you can just read those at your leisure in terms of enacting this kind of ordinance. The amendment that I'd like, which I guess you have in the packet for the author amendment, was suggested by people we met with today from the Department of Transportation, and there were two parts to it. One of it may now, going back, and I'm glad this bill has another stop, so we can continue working on it. The first part, which is taking off the word full and just writing cut off luminaire, they assured me that the definition that we had actually fit the definition of cutoff luminaire, not full cutoff luminaire. So we agreed to take the full out of it. That may or may not be a mistake. It's not clear what. This is clearly an improvement. It's not clear at this stage that we might not want to require the full. You know, again, from talking to Ms. Finwall and talking to Ms. Devenin, you know, that might not be necessary. So there are two places, but I would take it out at this point, and we'll discuss what this definition. We'll discuss, you know, when they came to me, it seemed easier to take out the word than to deal with this definition. So since they assured me, then the next thing, which was also a problem, I think, with the Department of Administration, on line 2.7 is the problem of maintained or operated. You know, that was obviously, and the example that I gave, if you look outside at the lights in front of the Capitol, you'll see that they are lights in complete violation. They're these beautiful round globes, which probably aren't historic. I don't think Cass Gilbert put those up. But these beautiful round globes, and obviously if somehow one of those is taken out, you don't want to put this socially responsible light in among all of the others. But we are talking about a whole plan for the total redoing of that whole Capitol front, which will move the whole street and will clearly change all of the lights. And at that point, at that issue, you would then clearly want to have at least a discussion, although you'll see there are exceptions. If you read the bill, there are exceptions for ornamental and so forth. But at that point, you would you would want to have a discussion, a full discussion of what kind of replacement lighting you had. So we took out maintained or operated. Was obviously too strong language to have in there. And one of the things that has been suggested, Ms. Finwall has said that there are other ordinances, and Ms. Devenin has told me that there is a model ordinance, and I think one of the things that I'd like to have added onto the bill before we go to local government or at the local government committee would be a model ordinance to make it easy for people to adopt an ordinance. And I guess we'll all stand for questions.
Representative Kahn, let's move your author's amendments. The chair will move the amendments that we have before us, members, as they have just been described by Representative Kahn on lines 1.16, 2.7, and 2.9. Are there any questions about the amendment? All those in favor adopting the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The amendments are adopted. Questions, members, for Representative Kahn or either of her testifiers? Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just wanted to mention that, to me, one of the prettiest sights in St. Paul is coming from the south on the High Bridge looking at the Capitol. I would not want to see the lights turned out. That's a very pretty picture at night. Mr. Chair, the question I have, if this passes and becomes law, I can understand communities who may want to do this, but if it's statewide, does this create light police? How do we police and how do we encourage? Is there teeth in here that makes people do this, or can you explain how it would work, please?
Representative Kahn.
Well, the mandate is on publicly funded lighting, and I would think, you know, one of the things I think one would like to do, put this on, so clearly light that the state has put up would be subjected to, you know, to the laws on this. What I think we would like to do is we would like to look at the enactment of ordinances around the state, and then that would then be, as Ms. Finwald described, that would be enforced as such ordinances are ordinarily enforced.
Thank you. That's
it. Other questions? Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, as I'm reading this, it means that this is a mandate from the state on all counties and cities to change their lighting systems. If they fall into the category of either a fixture being installed or replaced?
Yes.
Okay, another mandate. I appreciate that.
But you know, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Put that, Representative Osmond, at least in one of the incarnations of this bill, you were a co-author of it. But I think that's the main reason, a very good reason, not the main reason, it goes to local government is to fix that up, to put that kind of language, to maybe make it conditional on the adoption of an amendment, to put the kind of constraints that on that language that local government would feel necessary. For example, one could say after analysis of the costs involved and cost savings and so forth.
Representative Kahn and members, Mr. Eloff has an observation regarding Representative Nornes' question. Mr. Eloff, would you like to enlighten us?
Thank you.
Sorry about
thank
that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. pun taken note of. Representative Nornes asked about enforcement against violations. I'm just looking at this. This would be in Chapter 116, which is the Pollution Control Agency chapter. I'm looking at 116.072, Administrative Penalties, Subdivision 1. The commissioner may issue an order requiring violations to be corrected and administratively assessing monetary penalties for violations of this chapter. It would seem to me that administrative penalties from the PCA could potentially follow from a violation of this provision.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Representative Poppy, I believe you are next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, how would this affect high school athletic facilities?
It's specifically, if you look at 224.4, you see special events or situations require additional illumination. So, for example, the illumination installed shields the outdoor lighting fixtures, and I think that this is what has been being done in all new designs for outdoor lighting facilities. But anything, one of the things, and it ought to be clear that the language says this, with my limit, you know, I believe that anything that's temporary is allowed. You know, anything like like for a game, for a game in an outdoor stadium.
Representative Hoppe.
I was just asking because I have a high school football stadium right across the street from me, and I like that. It lights up the whole yard. It's great. I feel like the Griswolds. I don't want that to change. Go Hawks.
I'm on airport.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, how does this apply to airport lighting, which is very necessary for safety that certainly goes up in the air? Does this restrict that in any way?
Representative Kahn.
Where is that? It's specifically excluded somewhere.
Madam Chair, or yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I believe it's on line 2.4. Or starting on 2.3 and going to 2.4.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty. And to Representative Kahn, I would be much more comfortable supporting this bill if I could be reassured that this wasn't going to be an additional cost on local units of government or the state government. So in your discussions with the Department of Transportation, did you get reassurance from them that with your current language with, you know, if you install new fixtures or you're replacing old ones, that it's not going to be an additional cost to them? And has there been a fiscal note?
Representative Kahn.
The path of the bill would be, should it pass this committee at this time, which I hope it would be to go to local government, and would also be, there would be a requirement for a fiscal note. Department of Transportation, people can speak for themselves. They did talk about, you know, depending on what the cutoff is and what the on what the area is, there is, and this is one of the problems you guys are going to find out whenever you're doing anything with energy. There may be a higher initial cost that gets you to a larger saving over time and what you do. But one of the things they told me in terms of how they light a highway is that if you're cutting out how far the light spreads, then you may have to have more, you may have to have more fixtures. And so it's one of the reasons why we got into the replacement, you know, why we modified the language on operation and maintenance. But I guess Ms. Devenin has just told me that the whole approach to Red Wing, Tina, maybe you should say it yourself so I don't get it wrong.
About 3-4 years ago, about a mile section on the north end of Red Wing was redone, and it all has new light fixtures, which are the full cutoff light fixtures. Full cutoff is that you can put something underneath the light fixture and not touch the light bulb. And neighbors love it because the highway is lit, that it doesn't shine into your neighborhood. And so as far as you asked the question about sports field, another question was asked about airports. My son-in-law is a pilot, and he says, yes, their lights are very, very bright, and some of them are retrofitting them now with down lights whenever a down light can be used, because it's so much safer not to have a glaring light. Safety is a huge issue with glaring lights. And so the modern lights all recognize that and say, how can we provide light where it is needed and not where it is not needed, and cut down on the glare? Huge safety issue.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty. To follow up on that point, Representative Kahn, would you be willing to bring this bill back to this committee after you do have the fiscal note?
I think that's where it would come.
That is our intention, Representative Welty.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that
we'll want
to. I would like
that.
To get, I think the local government issues are very important. And we had a little discussion about this, and we've seen that it was better to send it to local government and to have that issue looked at there and then have it come back here with the fiscal, so this entire committee will see it again.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I had known this bill was going to be heard today, I might have done a little background work, but Mankato has actually done quite a bit of work in this area, and I don't know what's in statute or not, but it's because of request from the Minnesota State University Mankato. We have an observatory in Mankato, and the lighting was causing severe difficulty to the kind of work that they needed more darkness. So it wasn't just street lighting, it was developments, and they worked collaboratively in the community to reduce that problem so that the work at the observatory could continue. And it might be interesting information to find out more of how they proceeded to achieve that result, both with the city and with developers.
We will, and I've been just told that Mankato was an outstanding example, and we should definitely go there for more information and possible language.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, I represent four counties, I think 60 townships and 32 towns. I guess my concern with your bill, Representative, is that a lot of these 32 towns, in fact, only two of them are over 2,500 people, and so a lot of these towns are real small towns. And I'm concerned, frankly, at the cost that this mandate would put on those folks, and whether you would consider, a cutoff point, say 5,000 people, so none of my people have to fuss with this kind of a mandate.
Representative Kahn.
I think what you're seeing that we're doing is we're really grandfathering any existing light in. And certainly when it goes through one of the languages, and we'll look at what the languages in other state laws and the language in other ordinances are. We could certainly put in cost considerations. But if you look at the language if you look at the description of Calgary, which is probably bigger than any of your towns, I mean, it talks about, I didn't know that those towns had light. I mean, street lights and things like that.
They've got a TV and radio, too, now.
Thank you, Representative.
The point is, I don't know how often they would
even
go through it. They would go through a full change. I don't know how often they would go through a full change.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn,
you
have to come out to real Minnesota once in a while. And, now that we got wind turbines out there, we got electricity. We're all excited about getting more of them. But, some of these towns, and I don't know what their situation is, if they've got stockpiles or replacement lamps there and so on. And as I read this, if you replace a street light lamp, you've got to go out in your stockpile and throw those out and put the new ones in. And I guess I'm not really clear how it would affect the 32 smaller towns that I have.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Magnus, one of the reasons we have hearings on bills in the legislature and one of the reasons that we're asking this bill to proceed as slowly as possible so that you can ask that and so that if the bill is proceeding and people see it and they see the advantage, even if this doesn't become law, they're not going to go out and buy a whole big stockpile of the energy wasting light. They're more likely to buy the energy conserving light. So, that's the kind of information that we want as to whether we want to look at what places have done this. We're now 5 years after Maplewood has done it, plus many years after some state laws have been passed, plus many years after some local ordinance have been passed, and I think we can get these questions answered, not from me talking from the top of my head, but from people who've had experience with it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate that,
Magnus,
because these small towns don't get much public funds, and as I understand it, it would be the funds that they levy on the residents of their city, and I would like to know the cost that it would have to a town of 300 or 400 people, just what this would cost would do, and so if we could have this bill back again, Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate that. See it.
That is our plan, Representative Magnus. Representative Kalin and members would remind you that we do have other bills on the agenda, including one with the people who have traveled here to give us a presentation. So since we are going to see this bill back here after it has visited local government. If you have a question that could possibly wait until then, I would be grateful. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And three of my four comments were directly to questions that that I can address with privately with Representative Kahn based on these issues of mandate and passing the cost burden along. But to the subject of this committee, I think you know, Representative Kahn, that I'm really passionate about energy efficiency and saving energy and that we shouldn't be paying for this waste here. But if we're using the same bulb in a different fixture, can you tell me where we're getting the energy savings? And so I think when we, as we move forward and as we get this bill back, I want to see very clear accounting here for the savings that we get in terms of kilowatt hours per fixture and per bulb here. I love the efficiency part of it, saying we should be directing towards the purpose of this lighting, but I'm not convinced, and I guess we need to hear from the design community, the actual architects and planners who are not dealing with the policy part, but dealing the nitty-gritty. And I will happily talk to some of my contacts in architecture and in offices about the actual fixtures. But I think we need to know, essentially, to borrow a phrase from Representative Lagunias here, an energy note about our kilowatt-hour savings.
Representative Kahn.
I guess as you're not using the same bulb.
Ms. Slavin, okay. if you're going to comment, would you please direct your comments into the microphone, please?
Tina Fevenin, smaller wattage bulb with a illuminated background throws a lot more light on the ground. And so instead of having 100 watt to get a certain amount of light of ground, you now put it in a full cut of light fixture with an illuminated background, you can put in 65 watt and get the same amount of light on the ground. That's a very simple way of explaining. But your question is well asked, and it's the one that most people, it takes a little bit to understand that next step. But that's, in essence, what the theory is behind it.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that every single step that we take on energy efficiency is done in a way that people will do it and that it will achieve the goal that we want. And if we're putting our local partners on the defensive and in positions where they're not going to be full active participants, it gives us a great deal of caution. So I look forward to working with you, Representative Kahn, to solve these questions and have the accounting for it. Thank you.
Representative Gunther.
I'm fine.
Thank you, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If this bill comes back here, I would request that we have other sides to this discussion. We've heard, obviously, from one side is very passionate about this next crisis of the environment, I guess we're going to hear about. But I'm sure that the people who designed the light fixtures that are in barnyards and cities all over this state were not either stupid or mean or evil-spirited folks. They must have had a pretty darn good reason for designing the lights the way they did. So to those lobbyists and industry folks sitting in the audience, if you know somebody who would dare to come down here and maybe explain to us why what's been done has been done, and maybe a perspective that we're missing before we vote or discuss this further, I think that would be good for this committee. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Beard, and I believe we do have someone that wants to testify right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Dave Fielding. I'm Director of Plant Management in the Department of Administration. And I'm just seeking a clarification on a point, Section 2.28. And it goes to the question that Representative Norn has raised, which is, as you know, we illuminate the Capitol building. And my clarification is whether the reference to a single object is intended to include a building or simply a statue or some other memorial object, just so that we'll have guidance on how we need to proceed.
Thank you. And Representative Kahn, would you like to address that question?
Yeah, I would define a single object as also a building like the Capitol. I wouldn't want to say that every building needs to be illuminated the same way the Capitol is, But, you know, again, I think one could, that could be amended to say a single object or significant building.
Thank you. Are there further questions, members? Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Kahn, you know that I've seen this bill for a number of years now, and I think this is the first time it's actually seen the light of day. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm quite adequately familiar with this bill, and I would request a roll call vote.
A roll call has been requested. Before we call the roll, is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Please come down and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Starr. I work with MnDOT. I am an assistant state traffic engineer for Intelligent Transportation Systems. And our office develops specifications for lighting equipment that gets installed on MnDOT lighting projects and approves lighting products to be installed on lighting projects. And MnDOT, we recognize the intent of this bill and understand that we have concerns about it from the practical impacts on lighting systems on the roadways. We've done some analysis using lighting design software and the actual light photometrics from the manufacturers for these types of fixtures, and that we've determined that in many instances this would require a significant increase in the number of light fixtures at the same wattage to achieve the lighting levels and uniformities that are recommended in nationally accepted standards. And so there's a that would result in increased power use and increased cost for installation, maintenance, and operation, as well as some safety concerns because light poles do get hit on occasion, and the more we put out there, the more that would get hit. So MnDOT, I guess, opposes this bill based on the practical impacts it would have for our system.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Can I ask a
Representative Wiginius.
A very quick question. I'm glad you brought up safety concerns and lighting. Now in the morning in the dark, I drive in and there's a huge billboard flashing on 35W about 26th Street. And it changes every couple of seconds. What position is MnDOT taking on that distracting and I think very unsafe light?
I don't have an official MnDOT position on that. I'm involved more with the roadway lighting, and I haven't been involved in that issue on, with MnDOT. So I guess I can't answer that.
You could bring back an answer to us, though.
I could do that.
Thank you.
Would you do that, please?
I would do that.
Well, members, I think Representative Kahn has acknowledged that this is certainly a work in progress that will, we pass it out of this committee, be subject to the scrutiny by the local government committee that hopefully can answer many of the concerns that have been expressed here. And additionally, I think members will have the opportunity to discuss their concerns privately with Representative Kahn as she works on this bill. I don't think there's any commitment on the part of anyone to rush a bill forward that hasn't been completely vetted and thought through. And as we have noted, before this bill would advance to the House floor, it is coming back to this committee for further scrutiny. So I would encourage you, if you have concerns, to express them to Representative Kahn and see if we can work them out in the process. So if there are no further questions or comments, the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Beard?
Nay.
Lai?
Aye.
Reiner?
Aye.
Gardner?
No.
Gunther?
No.
Hackbarth?
No.
Hoppe?
Nope.
Johnson?
Yes.
Kalen?
Pass.
Knuth?
Yes.
Magnus?
No.
Nornes?
Osment?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Rude?
Aye.
Saylor?
Yes.
Slocum?
Yes.
Wagenius?
Yes.
Welty?
Yes.
Westrom?
No.
There being 11 ayes and 8 nays, the bill is passed on to the Committee on Local Government.
Thank you very much.
Representative Morrow. Representative Morrow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I come to speak on behalf of Bill, House File 472, regarding renewable energy production incentives. I have with me today David Arnold, a constituent from my district, who is also the owner of a wind farm, bringing energy to districts like Representative Magnus's.
Excuse me, Representative Morrow, we have to get your bill before us. Chair will move that House File 472 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm only going to speak briefly and turn to Mr. Arnold to explain what happened. But in generally speaking, Xcel Energy, when it received permission to store nuclear waste at Prairie Island, it agreed to fund certain programs, including this program, providing production incentives for renewable energy. It is that fund of money that we'll be talking about here in a moment with also a representative of the Department of Commerce. I do want to note that I had a telephone message this morning from Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy is good with this bill and has no objections. But I'm going to turn to Mr. Arnold to explain the situation in which he found himself.
Mr. Arnold.
Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Arnold, and I'm the CEO of Arnold Wind Farm, which is a one-turbine wind farm. It is a Vestas Micon 1.5 megawatt turbine. I am a farm equipment dealer, and wind energy appealed to me on all levels. Not only the clean energy part about it, but also how it helps out rural Minnesota. And my wind farm lease, or my turbine, is located in a little town called Wilmont, just north of Worthington, on the southern tip of the Buffalo Ridge. And my land lease with the farm family that owns that farm is a little different than most of the wind farm leases that you hear about. Because of my involvement with farming, and I think I know how farmers like to do things and operate, I set up my land lease in a crop sharing manner. I crop share the wind by giving a percentage of my total revenue to the farm family that that I lease the land from. In a nutshell, what happened here is that my wind turbine meets all the criteria and was the production incentive was actually designed specifically for a wind turbine setup like mine. I met all the criteria, had all the things in place in time. By the things in place, I mean the MISO study that determines whether the lines can handle the wattage. My land lease was in place. My PPA, that's the purchase agreement with the energy company to purchase my energy. All those things were in place in a timely manner. But I had one unfortunate happening. My application was returned to me in the mail damaged, and I resubmitted it. And through the process of all this going down, I missed the cutoff. So, unfortunately, I meet the criteria on every level except for missing the cutoff. I don't know how many other wind turbines this happened to, but at any rate, this legislative act, or this legislation, simply extends the cutoff date for the receipt of the application. And it involves no state money, and as Representative Morrow just said, XL's okay with it, too. It's a just one of those unlucky things.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. I believe we have someone from the Department of Commerce.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a representative for the Department of Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeremy DeFebri, and I work in the State Energy Office, and I'm responsible for the Renewable Energy Incentive Program. I'd just like to state that the department supports Mr. Arnold's request to have the extension granted to allow the odd circumstances that he found himself in to be rectified. I think when the incentive statute was amended in 2005, there was an effort to try and accommodate a number of different parties, and Mr. Arnold fell through the cracks, and we'd appreciate it if he were helped out.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the department. Is this the last example of who would need an extension out of this megawatt amount?
Mr. DeFebri.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Representative Peterson. He's the only one that I have on file from that period.
Thank you. No follow-up.
Further questions? Seeing none, the Chair will renew his motion that House File 472 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Those
pass.
Thank
you, Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Nice to be before a committee where consensus is the norm, and I'm sure the legislation that I'm asking you to consider today will fit that definition. It's as I said, it's good to be here. I'm joined at the table with John Howard and Steve Korsted from a company called Coronal. And this is House File 607.
And Representative Ansels, the chair will move that House File 607 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommendation to re-refer to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty, and members. A brief explanation of why this legislation is here and what it would do, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues for a brief presentation on the technological aspects of plasma gasification, waste to energy. The 06 capital investment bill from last year's session included $2.5 million in state bonding money for this project to be located in International Falls, Minnesota, which is in Couchiching County along the Canadian border, as you know. The grant monies that I'm asking for in this legislation are for $400,000 to conduct a feasibility study to assess elements associated with a proposed local, state, and federal project referred to as RECAP, which stands for Renewable Energy Clean Air Project. As I said, the project will be located in International Falls, which is in Coochiching County. I can envision it partnering and existing next door to Boise Cascade Paper Mill, and it is designed to reduce municipal solid waste currently going into landfills. It's designed to reduce transport costs. It's designed to safeguard water. It is a green energy project. It's good for the community, good for surrounding counties, and hopefully it will be part of the solution to municipal solid waste. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues, Mr. Howard and Mr. Korsted.
Mr. Chair, Steve Korsted with Cornell. We have six slides here and then a slight video, two-three-minute video that to show the committee. The video is an existing plant in Japan. Cornell is the consultant for Coochiching County. We have a contract with Coochiching County on this project. John wanted to really go through the spiel here, so I'm going to give it off to John. Thank you.
Mr. Howard.
Mr. Chair, John Howard for the record with Corona. Thank you all for your attention and the opportunity. To be real short here, we have an opportunity to do something very significant for the state of Minnesota and the United States in taking the position of being a leader. This is a presentation that we have given around the state with some variants on it. Real quick here, what you see in front of you is the Minnesota waste profile. This information was provided to us by the Minnesota Pollution Control. And basically what you see in the black is existing waste going into the ground. In the red, you see the waste to energy infrastructure within the state of Minnesota, which is aging. Two facilities have gone offline since they came online way back in the 90s. And then finally, what you see in the green is the recycling level for the entire state of Minnesota, which is plateaued. Now, what the state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Pollution Control has identified, 2011, they envisioned by their data, and this is also in their strategic plan, their vision, 2011, Minnesotans will produce 7 million tons of waste, and this is on the low end. This is a very optimistic view. While at the same time, the pollution control has set the goal and the vision in 2011 by reducing the waste stream that goes into the landfill by 15%. And what you see in the red is what we're really here to talk about, is the opportunity to expand waste-to-energy solutions throughout the state. Now, that red bar in 2011 will handle considerably much more waste than it does now in 2004-2005, which is about 2 million tons. In 2011, we'll be looking at processing 2.4 million tons. And the RECAP project speaks to a environmentally sound way of managing the municipal waste, we believe, within the state of Minnesota. And another significant piece about this, and not to harp on this just one slide, but the vision here, look at the numbers, 2011. Now, it takes 18 to 24 months for a facility of the nature of what we're talking about being constructed, built, and then to become operational. And so if we are to meet these goals, we truly have to act now. And so that's the take-home piece that I hope you will all appreciate about this. And so here you have a mixed slide, if you will. the footprint of the existing counties that we've communicated with and hope to work with on this program. Our solution will, which will reside in International Falls, will consume 36,000 tons annually. We've identified within this footprint in the green participating counties that there is available 66,000 some tons. Briefly, other things which you'll see here, the yellow dots are closed landfills, the red dots are open landfills, and the black square is existing waste to energy infrastructure. And so if you look at what's in the green, what you'll see are a lot of closed landfills. What's interesting about this technology, we also have the capability of excavating landfills to pull the waste out of the ground. In many instances, some of these landfills are leaching, and this is a viable way to address other environmental concerns. Be real brief here. This is a block diagram of the facility. As I said, you're going to see a 3-4 minute video on the operation of it real quick. Waste coming in, there's a materials recovery facility, a MRF, where we'll be able to pull out the valued products like aluminum cans, plastic, that otherwise would not be recycled. The waste then is introduced to the gasification chamber. Number two is the torch. Number four is the slag that comes off of the process. Once again, you'll see that in the video. The afterburner, which is 3 into 5, you see that's where we create the synthetic gas. Our synthetic gas has the capability of replacing one-for-one natural gas. And so one of the things within our feasibility study that we're going to touch on for Boise Cascade, for example, they have a gas-fired kiln where we can replace, as I said, that gas that they presently use, petroleum-based, and use our syngas. As you march through the rest of the diagram, there are other products, like at 9, we produce steam. We can, if need be, turn that steam into electrons all the way out to number 10. From an emissions, from a solids perspective, there's something called the Kyoto Protocol, okay? For those of us who haven't heard of that, that's the environmental standard that basically the rest of the world is marching under. The United States chose not to sign up for the Kyoto Protocol. The numbers that you see here, both so far as emissions and solids, for the gasification process functions today as we speak under that Kyoto Protocol. So it outperforms any environmental emission standard that we have in the United States today. This data is live data from the facilities in Yoshi, and you're going to see the video. What we have next to that, the incineration process, which is burning, that's another distinction between gasification and incineration. We function in an oxygen-deprived environment. So if you were to stand in the middle of our vessel and try to light a match, you couldn't do it, okay, because of the lack of oxygen. Incineration burns, and thus the problems. But the incineration numbers here are we pulled from a couple of facilities, and we tried to represent the best of the best in Minnesota. And when you see, for example, mercury, which is an issue for Minnesota, on the emission side, we are a better performer, almost 100 times better. Likewise, on the solid sides, the leachate, basically what seeps into the ground is what we also have a better process on. And once again, our numbers are considerably better. Speaking to the carbon footprint issue, which has popped up, and thank you for the discussion earlier today with the representative. We tried to capture what's happening at the all over the United States. These numbers are from the EPA, and so what you see in the black are landfill methane emissions. Okay. Methane is a greenhouse gas which is 12 to 20 times more gas that we can deal with. What you see also here in the orange, the landfill methane recovery projects like we're talking about to address the overall methane concern. Well, with our project, this is a moot point because at the end of the day, nothing goes to the landfill. And that's another key point that we hope you walk away with, because these numbers that you see here in front of you are methane is created after the waste has gone into the landfill. And so we have a process that, if you will, steps in front of the curve and does some very interesting things. Now, what you're about to see in front of you now, if I can do some magic here, you have a garbage truck, and this is the actual facility in Yoshi, Japan. One of the other concerns is that people say, oh, well, this doesn't exist. Well, as I said, here you're looking at a real facility. There are four facilities that are online, and there are another two facilities that are in the waiting wings that the Japanese are about to introduce. From a waste management, a manipulation of waste perspective, what you've seen thus far does not frighten anyone. Our existing waste management community does this and does it very well. Where it gets real interesting are after these augers, and what you see in front of you is a little square ingot, as they call it, which is 4 foot by 4 foot by 4 foot. It then makes its way to, this is the gasification chamber. This is the middle to bottom third. What you're focusing on now is the plasma torch. Now, you'll see a little residual fire burn off of, and there's some oxygen in that instance. But now you're looking down into the gasification chamber, and the bottom half of it is where we tap the chamber and the creation of slag, which is the inert material, okay? We can turn that inert material into usable product and thus the diversion of waste to the landfill. And this aggregate can do a couple of things. In that state, it can be used as road fill for road beds. There's a company in town, USG Interiors, that can turn that material into ceiling tiles. Here, the video is highlighting the components, gasification, afterburner, boiler, and then ultimately the turbine. And as we follow this along, now the back half of the solution, here again, is nothing that our waste-to-energy community within the state of Minnesota, for that fact, within the United States, is afraid of. What you see in front of you is something called a bag house. And a bag house is used to capture the fine particulates that are the output of this process, which then can be reused as feedstock. But what this facility, the Yoshi facility in Japan, decided to do was, surprise, surprise, they mixed it with concrete, and that waste then was turned into road pavers. And so the complete life cycle, cradle to grave, the community that generated the waste, and sorry for the washout here, developed a little kiosk to demonstrate this concept. And so what they used, they generated the waste, they sent it through this process, they built the kiosk based off of the output, it's off of the output of the facility, and this is what we're trying to bring to the state of Minnesota to be a leader in the United States and ultimately address the vision that the Minnesota Pollution Control has boldly laid out before us. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. Questions for Mr. Howard or Mr. Korstad? Mr. Representative Halpert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Howard, you and I have talked about this issue before during my office visiting me on it, and I think it's a good project. But
And I came in late, and I apologize for that. Did you talk about how much the whole thing is going to cost? You're asking us for $400,000. You applied for $300,000 from the USDA
Correct.
Program?
Correct.
Is that total what you need then is $700,000, or you can explain that.
Mr. Howard. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. $400,000 for the feasibility study. The total project is a $30 million project. Now, we applied to the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture. In their lack of wisdom, they gave us the catch-22. Let's just say that this is I still have issues with this organization. but in doing so,
Mr. Howard.
In doing so, they identified the value of this project and supported us so much so that they are frantically looking for alternative pots. And we've applied to those pots. But at the end of the day, the state of Minnesota has shown the leadership, and thus we're back here for the feasibility study. Now, what this feasibility study will speak to, technology, environmental concerns, economic development, and the overall maintenance and operation, there's interest from the Minnesota Pollution Control to address similar issues. So we're going down the same path. And so there's support in the quarters of the, as I said, the Minnesota Pollution Control for concepts like these to speak to that waste issue.
Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, related to the cost. Did you receive some bonding money for this from the state last year for this project? And secondly, if you said it, I missed it. Who's going to own and operate this project once it's done? Where do the profits go?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anselm, $2.5 million was included in the 06 bonding legislation for this project. And I'll let John answer the second part of your question.
Mr. Howard.
Mr. Chair, at the end of the day, Coochin County is going to be the owner and operator of this facility. And so the financial benefits, the economic side of this, they will reap the benefit of developing this project within Coochin County and working with their neighboring counties.
Okay. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is a great opportunity. I just have one little question that they asked about ethanol that was one at the time was unanswerable, but the energy in versus the energy out, what kind of answer can you give me for that?
Mr. Chairman, just jump in, guys. We, as I said, four facilities functioning today in Japan. Another two coming online. From an economic perspective, it's a business opportunity for them. So that, they wouldn't go down that path too far if the numbers didn't work. Now, from the energy balance perspective, what you're speaking to, as you release this table, for example. This table is exposed to the torch, this is the chemistry lesson. We expect you to take notes, and there's going to be a test after it. But this table or any material is exposed to the torch, there's enough energy in the torch to break up this solid material into its fundamental molecules. Okay. In the case of municipal solid waste, it's mostly carbon and other constituents, but also hydrogen is there. And so that's the major element of the syngas that, as I expose this table garbage to the torch, I then can siphon off the syngas, which is hydrogen and carbon rich, and then turn that into energy or send it to a fired boiler, and that's the beauty of it. And so at the end of the day, we have enough energy in the process to send electrons back, to send energy back to power the torch. So I just need an initial kickstart from the grid, and then I disconnect, and then I'm off and running as long as waste feedstock is coming into my chute.
Just like nuclear power.
Without the waste.
Further questions, members? Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This isn't really very specific, but you have a lot more technical background in this, obviously, than we do. And I'm just wondering if any organizations have put out any environmental red flags about this process.
Mr. Howard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. And there, for the record, there interesting approaches to this. As I said, there are a couple places where there are concerns. We get compared to incineration. As I said, we don't burn. That's the first key thing. The second aspect of this is the manipulation of the syngas. We're able to capture the syngas before it comes back together and create chemical nasties. Furans and dioxins. Okay, those are the other pollutants, and so we can capture the compounds and turn them into useful things before they get to the nasty side, and that's what happens in incineration because of the lower temperatures. We're at temperatures 18,000 degrees C. For the layperson, my partner here.
Include me in that.
Hotter than the surface of the sun. And so there are a number of places, quarters, that, as I said, like to link us to incineration. But that's the other key piece that this feasibility study will address definitively for not only for the state of Minnesota, but for the rest of the nation, because that's a key question that everyone asks is, oh, this really isn't, they call it incineration in disguise. And as I said, our feasibility study will definitively lay that to rest.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you showed us this slide on the difference between incineration and your process for heavy metals, you showed that you have less heavy metals. What happened in the solid waste? What happens to the rest of the heavy metals?
Mr. Howard.
Mr. Hilty, thank you. Representative Wagenius. We, as I said, there are two streams. The organic materials, they go to the creation of the syngas. The inorganic materials, the metals, the mercuries, the leads, all condense into this slag and then become concentrated. Now, when they're in this slag in the liquid state, they're free to move around and function like a liquid. But as they are cooled, and what you saw, that's what they were doing, quenching it in the water bath. As the slag comes off and it's cooled, the metals, there's a crystalline structure that's set up that will prevent you from having access to the heavy metals like mercury and the leads and the other things. And so at the atomic level, they're encapsulating. If this was a mercury atom, they're encapsulating that chemical nasty. And that's one of the other reasons why this technology outperforms from a leachate perspective what's presently out there today.
If I could follow up, Mr.
Representative Wagenius.
Cadmium doesn't disappear, so if it's not in the waste, does it go in the water or does it go into the air?
As I said, it's encapsulated. I'm sorry, Representative Chairperson Hilty. It's encapsulated, and so two exits. No other choice. by weight, the cadmium is in there, okay? If you were to grind that up and to create powder, you would not have access to the cadmium because there are other molecules, there are other atoms around that cadmium atom, okay? And so it's there by weight. You know, I wish that I could create energy out of, you know, the second law of thermodynamics. You can't recreate energy out of, you know, out of the air, if you will. And so it's in there. However, it's been rendered and put into a state in which you don't have access to it.
Okay, I could follow up one more time.
Representative Wagenius.
I understand your argument, but I can't see you with that argument why there's less lead, why there is less cadmium in your product than there is in incinerator ash. That was my question.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Carstair.
Yeah, my engineer is one of the best, but I'm a layman, so maybe I can explain it in that the mercury is in there, the cadmium is in there by weight and everything. It just doesn't leach out. So the numbers in that chart is what leaches out. So if you put that in water and have it soak for 20 years, very little of the mercury will leach out. The mercury stays in there. So it's the amount that leaches out of that is important for the environment because you don't want it to come out. So it's encapsulated in there, and then it just doesn't leach out. And that's why the environmentalists really like this approach. We're up at such high temperatures, hotter than the surface of the sun, exposing the garbage to it, that we can put it into this type of form, the inert inorganic materials, and encapsulate it and hold it there so it won't leach out. Does that help?
Let it go.
Representative Saylor and members, we are running out of time here. I'd like to be able to wrap this up before we get thrown out of the room. So hopefully we could keep the questions and the answers as brief as possible. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Howard, briefly, what does happen to the water in that water bath that the slag is used as a coolant for the slag? When does it evaporate? How is it cleaned, filtered, when you're no longer using that water?
Mr. Howard.
Mr. Hilton, yes. It's recycled. It is a closed loop. And so eventually there's more water added to it as through evaporation because also as I said, you're going down from extremely high temperatures down to something that's pretty cool in a short sense. And so there's some effluent or steam released, and that's replenished with water. And so it's not a something that goes into a spillway or anything. It's continuously recycled throughout the facility.
Representative Osman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that the technology that's being used here, the plasma torch, is not new technology. This is something that's been used all around the world for a significant period of time. This is just a new application of or a different application with regard to the United States. And it is a, to me, as when we had this information last year and we were authorized the $2.5 million in bonding, I thought we discussed or talked about the contingency study at that time, and could you tell me as to what happened or why did that the evaluation not go forward to where you could utilize the bonding dollars? Because we didn't know that we were issuing bonding dollars that you wouldn't be able to get access to right away. So can you maybe refresh my memory on some of that?
Mr. Howard.
Mr. Chairman Hilty, Representative Osmond. The bonding dollars from last year, $2.5 million, were designed or used to be used for the design and construction of the facility. At the time, we were using those funds, which the state provided, to speak to the federal government in terms of leveraging it for this for the program. We went into the whole process with that as the intent as you described. The USDA, as I said, in its infinite wisdom, directed us to a program, the Red Leg. The acronym is Red Leg, Rural Economic Development Loan and Grant Program. where you could apply for a grant, and all indications were that we were going to be successful. Well, what they came back with was, oh, you have to apply for a loan in addition to this grant. And so we're going to disqualify you for this round and resubmit you for the next quarter. Okay? We applied for the grant and the loan, and then they came back, and now our state office was involved in this. You know, David Gaffney, Steve Wenzel, when we applied for the second time, oh, well, you know, guys, the loan supersedes the grant, and the requirements of the loan say that you have to have a feasibility study. And so I was like, well, guys, hold on, time out. We applied for the grant to get the to have the feasibility study. So Catch-22 scenario set up and went all the way to Tom Doerr, the undersecretary of the Department of Agriculture, and it's still there. And the significance of this project is so high that we can't wait, and thus we're back asking for assistance. So that's what happened to us.
Thank you for the update.
Further questions, members? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion that House File 607 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommendation to re-refer to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
Thank you very much.
Bill is passed.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Welty, as you knew going into this, we might not get to you today. We'll put you first on the agenda on Monday. Members, the meeting is adjourned.